In real estate, you could be a great operator, a disciplined buyer, even a sharp negotiator. But if you're not tax efficient, you're giving away the very cash flow that you work so hard to create. Aligning your investment strategy with the right team and tools is more important than ever. Tax planning isn't just a defense. It can be one of the most profitable parts of your investment strategy. I'm Kevin Bupp, and this show exists to help you make smarter, more resilient decisions in every market cycle. And in today's environment, understanding tax strategy isn't optional. It's a core part of building durable, predictable cash flow. And so in today's show, we're going to be unpacking the following. We're going to talk about how cost segregation studies actually helps to shape your investment hold periods, the overall business plan of a respective deal, as well as your exit strategy. We're going to talk about the real audit risks that investors don't understand, and why documentation and financial organization matters more now than ever. And then lastly, we're going to cover some of the more advanced strategies that top operators can leverage in their business today. And to help us break it all down, I'm joined by someone who sits at the intersection of tax strategy and real-world operating experience. Kim Lockridge, who is the Executive Vice President at Engineered Tax Services, which is a firm that completes more than 800 cost seg studies each and every month. And just a little fun fact I'd like to share with you. Kim actually shared this offline before we started recording that she first invested in mobile home parks after listening to my podcast many years back and agrees that mobile home parks are one of the most tax efficient real estate investments that exist. So with that, Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I was looking back. It was like 17 or 18. So many, many years ago, a pandemic ago, right? Lots of changes that have happened over those last 7 or 8 years, but you know, excited to have you back here. And you know, I guess one thing that hasn't really changed all that much is the benefits associated with doing cost seg studies. So it's excited to have that conversation with you here today. I'll back it up a little bit for those that aren't familiar with you, Kim. Maybe just I'm going to throw it back to you for a minute or two and tell us a little bit of background of yourself, who you are, and what ETS does.
Yeah, fantastic. I appreciate that. So my name is Kim Lockridge. I'm the Executive Vice President of Engineered Tax Services. We are the largest specialty tax provider in the United States. We run cost segregation studies as well as research and development tax credit studies. And we also do energy certifications for new construction projects. The basis of this, I mean, I've been a real estate investor since the late 90s. I've been with this firm since 2009, so going on 17 years now. And I am on the tax and sustainability committees for the Real Estate Roundtable in Washington, D.C. That group is the largest lobbying group for real estate in the country. And collectively, the members of that group own 72% of all real estate in the United States. I'm happy to be on the show and share some of that expertise with you all.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And so, you know, cost seg studies, you know, I've been a real estate investor for 25 years now. I didn't know what a cost seg study was until back in 17 when Trump passed, you know, as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you know, 100% bonus depreciation. Obviously, that came on our radar at that point in time. We're on mobile home parks. As you know, mobile home parks are very tax efficient, especially when you get a cost seg study done on them. But, you know, prior to that, I was not familiar with the concept. And it seems as though I guess probably the general retail investor really wasn't. It wasn't a normal part of our nomenclature. It wasn't discussed. You didn't have multiple podcasts talking about the topic. And if you did, I didn't hear them. I didn't know anything about it. So
podcast, whatever podcast.
Yeah, I know. Whatever podcast. That's really funny. This isn't something new. Cost seg studies have been around for how long? Give us a little bit of a background, because this isn't just a new thing since Tax Cuts and Jobs Act came about. I mean, this has been going on for many, many years.
What's interesting is bonus depreciation actually has been around since 2006. But in 2006, it was reserved for new construction projects or new money spent, like improvements or whatnot. And it was only 50% bonus depreciation. And then it wasn't until the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 that we ended up getting that expanded to used property, not just new construction, and then also, you know, increased to the 100% bonus rather than 50. So that was a huge change. And that's when I saw it really hit mainstream.
Rocket fuel, pretty much.
Yeah, we've been doing cost segregation studies. I mean, our company has been around since 2001, so long before the bonus depreciation ever came about.
Well, for those that aren't familiar with what a cost seg study is, let's break down some mechanics of it and you know, talk to us like we're a second grader. No offense to those that are already well informed of what a cost seg is, but just again, give us the basics if you would.
Yeah, basics. You know, if you don't do a cost segregation study, you're putting your property either on a 39-year or 27.5-year schedule, depending upon the purpose, whether it's commercial or residential. When you do a cost segregation study, we get to carve out, instead of just appreciating that entire building on one line item, we're carving out a lot of the assets inside and outside the property to allow them to go into faster buckets so that you can get more depreciation. So instead of just having the whole property being, you know, depreciated over 27.5 years, now we would have different buckets. We'll have like a 5-year bucket or a 7-year bucket or a 15-year bucket. And then also the structure has to stay in the 27.5 and 39-year buckets. What's interesting to note, and a lot of people don't, they've heard of cost segregation, they hear about bonus depreciation, but they're not sure how it works, and they don't know how it goes together. But just to give you, a definition of it, bonus depreciation is a result of a cost segregation study in that bonus depreciation applies to the assets in a class life that is 20 years or less. So when we can take the asset from 39 years or 27.5 years, which do not qualify for bonus, and we carve out parts of that building into those 5, 7, and 15 year buckets, now that triggers for the bonus depreciation because it's under 20 years. And so that's how it actually works as far as the vehicle of how it gets those tax deductions in that current year so large. Bonus depreciation kicks in, and typically when you put assets into a 5 or 15 year bucket, you have to depreciate them over 5 and 15 years respectively. Okay. But when the bonus depreciation kicks in, instead of having a 5-year schedule, if you get 100% bonus depreciation, it says, you know what? You don't need to wait 5 or 15 years for this. You get 100% of it up front. So as soon as you put it into those buckets that are less than 20 years, it can trigger bonus depreciation if it's in the year that is qualified. And essentially you get to depreciate that entire asset all in year one instead of having to wait the 5 and 15 years for it. So that's where the cost segregation becomes very, very powerful and beneficial, is that we want to carve out as much as we can into those 5, 7, and 15 year buckets to make them eligible for the bonus depreciation that's qualified.
Would there ever be an instance where it makes sense for someone to conduct a cost seg study, but not necessarily take all that depreciation year one?
Yeah, I have that come up quite a bit. It's a little bit nuanced. You can do that. You can opt out of, say, the 5-year bucket and then take your 15-year bonus. But if you do that, then if you buy any appliances, you're opting out of all of it. It's not just on the purchase. It's all of it. If you opt out of 5-year, you opt out of 5-year across the board. Now you're kind of, you could be putting yourself at risk for future years. So it's not recommended, although you could. But, you know, in this case, I think it's important to note that, let's say you have a massive amount of deductions from the cost segregation study via bonus depreciation. And hypothetically, let's say you have $500,000 worth of losses or deductions from the cost seg, and your income's only $300,000. Well, you can use the $300,000 to offset your income, and the other $200,000 rolls over as a carry forward loss and it offsets your income for next year. So even if you can't use it all, you don't lose it. And the nice thing about that is that you don't really have to pick and choose what you want bonus on. You just take it all, claim it. It's on the books as a tax asset, and then you can carry it forward what you don't use.
Give us a better understanding. I guess in an instance where it might not make sense for someone to take it, in that, it helps them maybe, the calendar, this tax calendar year, but ultimately maybe they don't decide to hold that property for a long time. I mean, like it doesn't, once you take that loss, like there is the risk associated with recapture, right? And so like, Is that a consideration, would you say, for folks? I mean, you know, that are considering taking, they need a loss to buy real estate, but like more than likely, maybe they're not long-term holders. Like they intend to maybe flip it at a later, you know, at a later date, but only within the next couple of years, 2, 3, 4 years down the road. Would it still make sense for them to go the cost seg route and take all that depreciation year one?
It does. And it does for multiple reasons, because when you do a cost segregation study, it is true that you're accelerating depreciation. So it's kind of like taking an advance on a paycheck. You start a job, you tell your boss you're going to work for 5 years and you want him to pay you 5 years up front, but then you quit your job in year three. You're going to have to pay back 2 years of that wage, right? You've already worked off some of it. So you're not having to pay back all of it. It is prorated, but also, you know, think of it this way, instead of thinking of it, well, I don't want to take all the deductions now because I might have to pay them back in the year I sell. What happens if you don't sell? You know, then you still get to use that deduction. And so I look at it like a loan from the IRS at 0% interest, you know, because you would be taking money out anyways to get the improvements done or maybe to buy some equipment or do something like that. So why not just take the money that is allowed to give you from the IRS and then pay it back when you sell the property, when you have the proceeds? That's the worst case scenario. But one of the other things that you could do to offset and not have to pay that recapture back is that you could just do a 1031 exchange out of it in year five, you know, or year four. Now, I like to flip my properties. I'm in wealth building mode. And so I don't ever buy a property and hold it forever. That's one of the worst things that you can do for wealth building, because you have so much phantom equity that gets stuck in those properties and your buildings are going to continue to deteriorate, right? So I like to flip mine every 5 years, take the depreciation, and then go into a bigger property with more cash flow and continue to build my wealth instead of, you know, I'm going to buy a property for each one of my kids. And then when I'm dead, they're going to have something that's 30, 40, 50 years old that they're going to go, really? Do we want this property? You know, I want to continue to build something so that it's worth a lot more, because they'd rather have the cash, right, than the properties. So yeah, I think there's a huge, your question, do we take that into consideration? Absolutely. I would never suggest doing a cost seg study and then selling a building without conferring with your CPA and running a pro forma before to know what the tax liability is going to be. And for you to weigh your options, you can always 1031 into a DST at the end of your life, you know, if you don't want to own property anymore. But also you can do a lazy 1031 exchange, you know, and still offset the income. So there's so many different ways to get around it, even with short-term holds. I would highly recommend doing the cost segregation. And also the other factor that we haven't talked about is the partial asset disposition, you know, because if you're doing, you know, chances are you're not going to sell a property in just a couple of years without doing some CapEx to increase the value of that property and increase the equity you have. So when you're doing improvements, you're removing assets from the existing building, right? So I'll give you an example of partial asset disposition. You know, you buy a building, it has a roof. That roof is a 39-year asset, say. And then you turn around and in year five, now you bought that building, it was new to you and you spent a lot of money on it, but it was 20 years old. And so in year five, you have to replace the roof because it's deteriorated and maybe that was original. Well, what happens when you do not have a cost segregation study to segment all the assets in that property, you're going to depreciate the entire building on that 39-year schedule, and then you're required to capitalize the roof. Okay. Now you have two roofs on your books, one of which doesn't even exist. So partial asset disposition is extremely valuable, because going back to the recapture topic, recapture is not only the gain from the sale, but it's also the accumulated depreciation that you've brought along the way. And so if you can eliminate the accumulated depreciation by doing partial asset disposition, you're going to actually benefit yourself in the recapture and make those more favorable. So what you do is you do a cost seg study, you establish the value of that first roof, When you take it off to put on the new roof, now you actually physically take a calculation or an expense of the remaining depreciation of that old roof and you take it off your books. So no more, it's not accumulating depreciation anymore. So arguably, partial asset disposition is more valuable in the long run than even bonus depreciation. So don't forget about that. And it also helps you in the end when you sell to alleviate some of those recapture costs because you've done the disposition, gotten those assets off the books.
Have you found that like your typical CPA accountant, are they well versed on this, these kind of topics, like the partial asset disposition? No, they're not, right? Like, so I think that's where a lot of folks kind of miss the mark, is that there's a lot of these additional opportunities for you, that your average, you know, tax advisor has no idea of. And so you're leaving quite a bit of money on the table. So, and I want to, there's a lot there, Kim. There's quite a bit I want to unpack. I definitely want to talk about the lazy 1031. I'm sure you piqued some interest there. That, I feel like that's some new terminology that started getting thrown around in the last couple of years. And we definitely want to dive into that, but would love some clarity as well here. I think that, you know, there's a lot of advertisements you get on Facebook. There's quite a bit of advertisement, especially now that we're, you know, ending the calendar year, you know, certain folks are out there looking for passive losses. So a lot of real estate investment groups are really touting the benefits of bonus depreciation. And, but it's not necessarily applicable to everybody. You know, if you're a high income earner, W-2 earner, you know, there's some instances where you might not be able to take advantage of those passive losses. Is that correct?
Yes and no. You can still take advantage of them, if you're a passive investor. So when we talk about taking the deductions at $300,000 and offsetting, you know, $300,000 worth of income, of course, that's if you're a real estate professional, right? If you qualify. Now, you don't have to have a license, you just have to have the hours and that kind of stuff. And that's a whole other podcast.
750 hours a year. Is that what it is?
Yeah. Of active management. Yeah. Active management, not searching for properties, but active management. Yes. And it has to, you have to have a log and you have to have the documentation. And so 750 hours a year of active participation, but it also needs to be more hours than you do anything else. So if you have a full-time W-2 job, it's pretty hard to claim that you are also a real estate professional unless you're in real estate. You know, if you're not a real estate professional, consider making your spouse a real estate professional. There's a lot of things you can do. But if you're not, and your passive activity still does qualify, you can take some losses. And if you have other passive activity, you can group the passive losses with the passive income. You can group those together. Okay. So if you group those together, that ultimately allows you to take those in the bucket. So in your tax return, think of two different sides of your tax return. You have your active or ordinary income, usually your W-2, right? And then you have your passive things that are, you know, investments, stocks, those types of things, real estate investing if you're not a real estate professional. What happens, there's a line down the middle and you can't cross the line. So if you take a bunch of passive losses over here, it's not going to offset your ordinary income. Okay. So they're different buckets with that line separating. What happens when you become a real estate professional? It makes that line disappear and now everything melds together. That's why your losses offset your W-2. Okay. But if you're passive and it has to stay on the passive side, then the losses stay on that passive side. So if you have other passive income, you can group those activities together. And so therefore you can use the losses, but also, you know, you may not, usually my passive investors will eat through the deductions in maybe 2 to 5 years, depending on their situation, depending on how much income they're making. But, so it is very helpful to offset that. And so it elongates, the bonus depreciation, but it gives you a tax asset that you're carrying on the books. And so let's say, for instance, you have $300,000 worth of losses sitting on your tax return in your passive side, and you have a bunch of money that you want to get out of, like an IRA, you want to do an IRA conversion, you're going to have to pay tax on that IRA conversion. But if you have these losses and you bundle those together, you might be able to offset the gain. So it becomes a tax strategy to have those losses on your books to be able able to play with them and see what can I do. Maybe I can go flip a property real quick and make, you know, 50, 60, 100,000 or $1 million, whatever your flips are making. And then you turn around and flip that property. And now you have that as your passive. And now you can offset that with the cost egg. So you really want to get strategic about, don't just throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, just because I'm passive, that I can't use cost segregation, because it's completely untrue. You just have to get smarter about it.
At some point, you're going to find a use for it, right? It doesn't go away. It's there for you when you need it.
Well, and one other point, and this is, I think, the biggest point when you're a passive investor, and this is the point that 90% of the CPAs do not tell their clients, and they miss this, is that let's say you are carrying $300,000 worth of losses from your cost seg study. Okay, let's just say you're carrying them year after year after year. And then you go to sell that property. Guess what? That $300,000 gets unlocked. It offsets your gain and it offsets your ordinary income. So you will eventually benefit from it. It just takes a little bit longer if you don't have the real estate professional status. So think of long term. Don't just think of right now, what is this going to do? Think of the partial asset disposition. Think of having the benefit, that Bible for your building that breaks down all your assets, being able to do improvements and take those assets off the books as you go, minimizing your recapture, and then turning around and opening up all those losses to your ordinary offset as soon as you sell the building. So it could be a very, very strategic plan for your taxes.
And I know this is a little bit of a loaded question, but what is the typical cost of a cost seg study?
Yeah, loaded. You're right.
Very loaded. I get it. Maybe a range. Let's make the assumption. Let's make the assumption we're talking. I guess it doesn't necessarily matter the price point of a property. A lot of it's the size and type of property is. And so, yeah, I get it. That's a hard question to answer, but I guess where I'm going with that is, I made an introduction the other day. I was having a conversation with a good friend of mine. We were talking real estate on the way to go watch the Tampa Bay Bucks play. And, he's got a bunch of residential property, residential rentals. And, planting seeds with a really smart business guy, but he's done a horrible job with his tax planning. I mean, literally every year I'm like, you wrote how big of a check? What is wrong with you? You know, and he strategically tries to go buy real estate. He's trying to be smart, but you know, he's starting to really see the light. As him and I have conversations every year about what I didn't pay in taxes, what he did pay in taxes, and he's wondering what he's doing wrong. And so he's like, well, do you think it would make sense? Do you have someone that you could recommend that does cost seg studies? I'd like to look at getting maybe a couple of my residential rentals, get a study done on them. And I guess, you know, the question he kind of posed is like, you know, based on the cost of the study, does it make sense maybe to even do it on like a, you know, call it one of these properties he's bought as a $600,000 property? Does it make sense at that point in time?
It makes absolute sense. I typically still do. I mean, all day long, I have clients that are buying properties for $80,000-$90,000 still in like Detroit, and we're doing a cost seg study on them. So a property that's $600,000, let's assume that it's a single family home, right? Let's just assume that it's single family home for a rental, whether it's short-term rental or long-term rental, $600,000. If you pull out 20% for land, that leaves you a basis of $480,000. And then we're probably going to yield about $144,000 in tax deductions from that property. So $144,000, now let's say that you're at a 30% tax bracket effective, that's a $43,000 cash benefit back in your pocket. It's going to save you $43,000 in taxes. Well, that cost of that single family home might have been $3,000. So $3,000 divided by 43,000, you know, I think the return on investment is pretty damn good. I would do that deal any day. so that's how it pencils out. And, you know, let's say you're buying a mobile home park, right? And you know, it's $2 million or something. You're probably looking at maybe 4,000, maybe 5,000 for a study. We look at three factors. We look at location, because labor in LA is more than labor in Ohio, right? So we look at location. We look at a property type, like a medical office building is going to take us a lot more time than going through a storage warehouse. And then the square footage, because a 100,000 square foot building is going to take us a lot longer than a 3,000 square foot building. So those are the three factors. I would say on average, commercial property is going to be 4,000 to 8,000, depending on all of those factors. And then a single family home is going to be about 3,000, give or take a couple hundred. Please don't quote me on that. There is a variance to it. Don't say Kevin said.
As we said, loaded question. So yeah, there's a range, guys. There's a range. Yeah. Reach out to Kim if you have questions about your specific, you know, property type or property that you own.
Yeah. And be really, really careful with the software-based studies that are out there right now. There's a lot of companies popping up that haven't been around for very long, and they came up through COVID and they started a business and they're either doing virtual site visits or not a site visit at all, or they're sending like an appraiser or a photographer. That is not a qualified building professional. So be really careful, buyer beware. The IRS still says you have to have an in-person site visit. They only allowed the virtual site visits during COVID. Now that COVID is over, you have to prove that you had an in-person site visit by a qualified building professional. So please, please, please don't get taken for one of these software based. It's not a real breakout. You cannot calculate the partial asset disposition later on. You need a full-blown engineered based study with an in-person site visit and make sure that the detail is in the final report. So it's very, very important.
You guys offer free cost benefit analysis, right? I mean, so if folks have questions, if they got a property, like get an idea of what it might cost them, or just generally how beneficial it might be for them to do a cost like study. You guys provide that info. I mean, you provide that service.
Of course. Absolutely.
Let's keep the real estate investor hat on here. So you just mentioned mobile home parks. You know, I love mobile home parks. They're incredibly tax efficient. I would argue probably one of the most tax efficient. However, there's a couple others that kind of fall into that same bucket as well. And so I know that you're an active investor. I believe that in addition to mobile home parks, which you've invested over the years, you've also purchased gas stations and car washes. If you had to make a list of the top five, highest tax advantaged asset types, would those three fall in that bucket? And if so, then what are the other two that you'd put in there?
Yeah, great question. And I get this a lot. So the top benefits from cost segregation by property type is what we call this. And that would be number one, would be gas stations and car washes tied for number one.
Okay.
That's because those property types, if it meets a criteria, has special rules that date back to 2011, and a lot of CPAs miss it. So those are the best ones to do. Give you an example on a $1 million car wash, pull out 20% for land, because land is not depreciable. That leaves you with a basis of $800,000. That entire amount goes into a 15-year bucket for the special rules, which qualifies it for bonus, which means that you get an $800,000 tax deduction in year one. So then you wonder why there's car washes popping up on every single corner in every single state and every city. So that's the first one. The second one would be mobile home parks, and RV parks. And simply because there's usually not a lot of structure and mostly infrastructure in the, in the ground, all of your electrical, the pads, all that stuff. So that typically will yield somewhere between 62% and 95% usually in COSIC study results. Third would be medical office buildings. I would say, self-storage would be number three. Self-storage, the all metal building self-storage would be third. Fourth would be medical office buildings. They do have a lot of mechanical, electrical, and plumbing, especially surgical centers. So those would be number four. And number five would probably be a mix between office, multifamily, distribution centers, maybe. So they would all kind of fall in that last category. And then the worst would be like a straight up storage warehouse that really doesn't have a lot of finishes in it. Not manufacturing, that's different, but just a box,
Got it. If fair warning, everybody, car washes are good investments. I've actually got some personal money in some car washes, but I live in Florida. You literally see there's got to be at least three for every mile going down a major corridor, and some of them are suffering now. And so to your point, just because the tax benefits are great, might not, you still got to underwrite the deal, make sure that the economics work and that it's a good viable investment, and not just because it's got good tax benefits. So There's maybe some folks out there, Kim, that would still do it just for the tax benefits. But I would say try to make sure that the investment is solid as well.
I always just tell people, like, if the deal does not pencil out on its own without the tax benefits, then don't do it. You know, I mean, the tax benefits are a cherry on top, but tax rules change. Things, you know, anything can change. So just be very careful.
We kind of share the same sentiment with, like, when we're underwriting deals. If it only makes sense with, like, you know, full term interest only, you know, the deal can't stand on its own with, like, a fully amortizing loan, like, not necessarily pass, but, like, you know, like, if you're having to financially engineer something to barely make sense, probably doesn't make sense. Probably move on to something else. So you've had your own personal experiences. You've gone through, you know, what most of us would perceive to be as a nightmare. You know, some of us that are probably tuning in here have gone down this road, not by choice, but you've been audited. And so you've been down this path. You've dealt with this personally. Any insights that you walked away from as a result of that audit? Any advice that you could give listeners that might find themselves in a similar situation?
Yeah, my audit was a little bit different than a traditional audit. Usually people will get an IDR with maybe four or five topics that they want to check in your or a question. And mine was a full research audit, and the IRS calls this a community service. And that's because it is so elaborate. These types of audits are extremely nuanced. They want every receipt for every deduction for every line item on every page of your tax return. And I had to provide an enormous amount of documentation. I had two mobile home parks, over 100 tenants, multifamily, 800 doors. I had a ton of rentals, short-term rentals, long-term rentals, commercial property, about 50 K-1s that came into my tax return in addition to those, you know, direct owned. So there was a lot. And, you know, it was, it took me about 6 months to get through it. She told me it'd be 9 months to a year. And, it was because of the record keeping. So I will tell you, I mean, yeah, there were some long nights going through boxes of receipts to make sure I had everything, but having a good set of books, it saved me. It really did. I looked at my husband and I told him, I'm like, man, well, I called my attorney first and I said, you know, I got this IDR and I was like, you know, there's some information on it. I just figured it was a regular audit. And he's like, no, Kim, this is a research audit. He says, in my 35 year career, I've only had one other person who's had a research audit. And to defend you on this, I'm going to charge you $20,000 just to defend you. And I was looking at all the IDRs and the information they were requesting. And I mean, I'm in tax, right? I mean, I don't do tax returns, but I know enough to be dangerous. And I was like, you know, I'm going to take my chances. So I didn't hire him to do my defense. I did the audit myself and I provided her with all of the documentation, one property, one mobile home park to get all the documentation that she was asking. It was over 800 pages. It was a ream and a half of paper because she wanted every single lease from every tenant. She wanted every utility bill. She wanted the appraisal, the land value, the cost study. She wanted absolutely everything that you can possibly dig up for these. And, you know, I had it all and I put it all and I bookmarked it all. I was very, very, very detail oriented. I just laid it out and literally walked out of there. And I told my husband after this, I said, you know, if we walk out of this audit owing less than $25,000, I will be happy. Cause I'm a very aggressive tax filer. So I was a little bit worried. but we ended up walking away writing a check for $1,200 and only because my CPA made a $4,500 mistake that I found. And so, everything was documented and I was super thrilled. I could not write that check fast enough. And, to get them out of my hair after 6 months was quite the feat. But my advice, you know, to that story is that, you know, a lot of people don't take their record keeping seriously. They don't keep really good records on their miles. They don't keep every receipt. They just think, oh, I'm just going to go through my credit card statement. Credit card statements are not enough. I had the credit card statement. I had the bank account records, but they wanted the physical receipt to see exactly what the product was that we bought and what the purpose was. And so it was really important for you to not just do your transactions in QuickBooks and, but make sure that you have the receipts saved and you can attach them to QuickBooks or a lot of those bookkeeping services do that for you now. Make sure you have everything to back it up, you know, or just know that they will probably take it away and you won't be able to use it as a deduction. Bank statements and credit card statements are just not enough to cut it.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. I mean, we're very diligent, you know, on the company side, right? Like all of our vendors, they've got to do a vendor packet and, you know, everything's got to be documented. And so we've got all that information, but I would guess that a lot of smaller, I mean, I can think of myself back when I started buying real estate. I mean, you got, you know, some vendors you're paying on the table, right? Like you're paying them cash, but you're pulling it out of your company bank. I mean, just like you're doing little things like that, not thinking that's going to come back and bite you. And ultimately, you know, how many of us hold on to physical receipts, right? We're running a small business. It's just, I would like to think that most of us are diligent enough to do that, but I just know that that's not the case. And those receipts get thrown in the trash can. We don't scan them. And then I can imagine the headache that unravels and unfolds when you go through an audit like this. So were you made aware of like what the red flag was? What threw up the red flag?
They don't tell you. They'll never tell you why you were triggered an audit. But what we do know, if there's anything in your tax return that doesn't quite add up to whatever was sent to them. So if your W-2s don't add up, another small mistake that my CPA had made and I didn't catch it was an $11 mistake on the first line item, which was wages. So when you put the two W-2s together, it was off by $11. And they got copies of the W-2s and they saw that and the amount of income that rolls through our tax return, they thought this was going to be a gold mine, because if that's the first line item that's off by $11, where else can we find money? So there were little things like that that they did challenge. They challenged my real estate professional status. I don't want to brag too much because we were two W-2 income earners and we took real estate professional status, which is a huge no-no that a lot of CPAs will tell you that will just flag an audit. It did, but they allowed us to keep the real estate professional status, which was huge for us. And that's because, you know, I had extenuating circumstances. So just be very, very careful with what you're doing. I did have a client that got audited. We did a COSIG study on, and because we offer audit defense, a COSIG was part of the topic. The problem, though, was that we delivered the cost segregation results with the dates and the basis that was provided to us. And the client went to their CPA and decided to claim it in a different year. Ultimately, what happened was not only did they get that taken away from them, but they were also flagged for, criminal charges. You know, it was fraudulent charges because they deliberately changed the date to give them a better benefit, moving the place and service date. So I'd be very, very careful, be very diligent, make sure that you keep your documents. I mean, QuickBooks, well, you can literally scan a picture of your receipt. It'll automatically scan it for you into the system. And then you can just tag it later and match it up with the book records or bank records. So I would just be very careful. Please take the time to have the documentation to save yourself. Because I'll tell you what, it's murder if you don't have that.
Yeah, and we've got smartphones. We've all have no excuse as to why we can't snap a photo, right, of the receipt at this point in time and have it, you know, electronically get filed away very quickly, really, you know, very easily. You know, I guess as we round this out here, Kim, I wanted to cover this one last topic. You mentioned it earlier on. It's the lazy 1031. Maybe you can speak a little bit more to that. I know that's not... it's not necessarily a thing per se. It's just it's more of a methodology. But maybe speak to a little bit about what that is and what that means.
Yeah. You know, it's super easy. 1031 exchange, traditional, essentially you have to sell a property and use the proceeds to buy another property. You have 45 days to identify the new property and you have 6 months to close. Okay. So they're very strict dates and very strict rules. Not everyone can identify a property in 45 days. That's a pretty short time period. Or what if you find a property and then it falls out in due diligence and you're like, I can't buy this property. And now you're screwed. You just failed your 1031 exchange. All is not lost. A lazy 1031 exchange, and follow me through the concept here, is say in the same tax year. Now that is the number one key for this. It will not work if you do different tax years. So in the very same tax year, you sell a property and then you buy another property. Okay. Don't do a 1031 exchange, a traditional. You essentially have your proceeds and your recapture at this point, and then you do a cost-seg study on your new property and you use those those losses to offset the recapture and the capital gain from the one that you sold. As long as it happens in the same tax year, then you can actually group those assets together, and then you end up having the same results as a 1031 exchange, except for it doesn't reduce your basis. Okay. And that's a key thing in a 1031 exchange. Let's say you sell a property and you have $500,000 of gain, and then you buy another property for $200,000. When you bring in that gain, your basis for depreciation is only 1.5. You lose that $500,000 of basis. Okay. So you can't depreciate that asset. And then you're also kicking the can down the road. You're going to owe the tax on that $500,000. Okay. You will owe it. And what happens is you're just kicking the can. It's a tax deferral. So if ever you sell that property, now you're going to have to pay the proceeds from the $500,000 plus whatever you gained on the new property. So there are some downfalls to the 1031 exchange. Whereas if you do a lazy 1031 exchange, you don't reduce the basis. You're still using the $2 million over here for the new property. And essentially, you're not kicking the can down the road. You're satisfying your tax liability in that year with the bonus depreciation from the purchase of the new property. So there's a lot of benefits. And we see this in, you know, divorces a lot, where you own property with your spouse and you have to sell the property. And now you want a 1031 exchange because you don't want to pay the tax liability, but you don't really want to be partners with your spouse anymore. You know, it's like if you do a 1031 exchange, you have to use the same entity. You can't change an entity. So now the structure, you'd have to restructure everything. So then that poses a problem. So we see lazy 1031 exchanges solving a lot of problems with, you know, preventing the can from being kicked down the road. You're satisfying the tax liability. You're not reducing the basis, and you know, you don't have the same requirements of having to buy it under the same entity name.
No, I mean, some would argue that it's actually even a better strategy. But again, the same thing applies. So you have to do your due diligence, right? You can't just turn around, sell a property and go invest with a bunch of different syndicators out there and gain that benefit. Know what you're investing into, know what, you know, what the actual deal is. You're comfortable with it. And if you can't get comfortable with the deal, you can't find a deal in the lazy 1031 way, you can't find a replacement property via the regular 1031, then pay the gains. You know, just pay the gains.
Pay the gains.
Well, Kim, this has been a lot of fun. Always, you know, it's been too long since we had you on. Like I said, I think it was back in 2018 when we had you on last. But I'm glad to hear that everything's going great with the company. You guys are growing like gangbusters. Super busy, and glad to hear that everything turned out well with the audit. That's a moment in history that you won't forget, I'm sure. And a little bit of scar tissue there that will never go away. But you're stronger because of it. So before we wrap things up here, just I want to give you an opportunity for any final thoughts you might have for the audience. Any, you know, investing advice, tax advice, words of wisdom, whatever it might be, before we say goodbye.
Well, I do have some a piece of advice, a quote that I always use in all of my presentations, and I think it's a good one. But you know, essentially, we do believe that everyone should pay tax, but there's nothing in the code that says you have to leave a tip. So We're in the business of taking the tip off the table.
I'll borrow that from you. Thank you, Kim, so much for being here, guys. And thank you for listening in and tuning into another episode of the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed the show here today, please do take a moment, subscribe, leave a rating and review. It allows us to attract amazing guests like Kim to the show, not just one time, but maybe back again for a follow-up. With that, I appreciate everyone's time today. So until next week's show, wishing you strong deals and even stronger cash flow. Take care now.